This podcast is brought to you by Luca Mele, front-end architecture, team leadership, and technical consulting. Over 16 years of experience turning complex challenges into simple, effective solutions. Learn more at lucamele.ch.
If you were to open up a senior developer's pull request right now, honestly, there is a very high chance they're making the exact same performance-killing React mistakes as, like, a first-year intern.
Oh, absolutely. It's wild.
Right. Like, you will see people wrapping a simple string concatenation in a use memo hook.
Yeah.
Or throwing an array index on a list as a key just to make that red console warning disappear.
Yeah, the classic index key. It is just a pervasive issue across the entire industry right now. And, I mean, it happens because the mental model most of us are taught for React is just deceptively simple.
Yeah, it's pitched as this magic tool, right?
Exactly.
Right.
We're told it's declarative, like you just describe the UI you want and the library handles all the messy DOM manipulation under the hood.
Mm.
But if you rely on that surface-level promise without actually understanding the underlying mechanics, well, you end up with incredibly fragile applications.
And that tension is exactly what we're exploring in today's deep dive. We're looking at why so many of us constantly get React wrong, and obviously how to fix it.
Because we all want to fix it.
Right. So our guide for this is a really hard-hitting article titled React Do's and Don'ts, Fiber Reconciliation, and the Hooks Nobody Uses Right. And it's written by Luca Mele.
Yeah. And to give this some serious weight, we are also pulling from his broader architectural manifesto, his best practices file, and his professional background.
Which is extensive. I mean, we're talking about someone with over 16 years of experience leading front-end architecture for major Swiss institutions.
Yeah, places like UBS, Migros, Vontobel, AXA.
Right, massive places. He has managed code bases at a scale where minor inefficiencies, like, they just compound into massive performance bottlenecks.
They really do.
Mm.
And his core thesis across all these materials is that those recurring pull request comments we were just talking about, they aren't just minor oversights.
No, they're symptoms.
Exactly. Developers are treating the symptoms of bad performance rather than understanding the engine they're actually trying to drive.
Yeah.
So our goal today is to, well, look directly at the engine.
So to equip you with a true understanding of that machinery, we want to move past those surface-level hacks so you can write cleaner code and avoid the traps that plague basically most modern code bases. But to do that, we first have to strip away the illusion of JSX.
I love that phrasing, the illusion of JSX, because when you write it, it feels and looks like you are just writing HTML.
It really does. It fools you.
But you aren't. You're actually writing a set of instructions like a description of a tree of JavaScript objects.
Mm-hmm.
React takes those instructions and uses them to construct what is called the fiber tree.
Right, the fiber tree. That's a term that gets thrown around in advanced tutorials a lot. But let's ground it for the listener. What is it structurally, like under the hood?
So think of the fiber tree as a highly complex blueprint of everything currently on the screen. Technically speaking, it's a linked list of work units.
Okay, a linked list, so not just an object.
Right, not a massive global object. I say linked list, meaning each unit strictly points to the next one in line. Every single node in that tree represents one element or component in your user interface.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and it holds pointers to its first child, its next sibling, and its parent.
So traversing it is a very sequential, very strict process.
Very sequential.
Right.
And every node holds critical information. It holds the component's props, a reference to the physical DOM node it represents, and really importantly, it holds the hook state.
Okay, wait.
And interestingly, the hook state for a component is also stored as a linked list inside that specific node.
Oh, okay. If the hooks are stored as linked lists, that completely explains why the React documentation is so aggressive about never putting hooks inside conditionals.
Yes. You nailed it.
Because if a conditional evaluates to false and skips a hook, it breaks the sequence of those pointers, right?
Exactly.
And then React suddenly assigns the state of hook number 3 to hook number 4, and your whole app crashes.
That is the exact mechanism behind that rule. The sequence must remain immutable. Now, the text points out that React doesn't just maintain one of these fiber trees, it actually maintains two.
Right, the current and the work in progress.
Yeah. There is the current tree representing what you are actively seeing on screen. But when a state change happens and a render is triggered, React does not immediately touch the live DOM.
Which would be super slow.
Right. Instead, it starts building a second tree in the background, which is the work in progress tree.
Basically, it's building a draft.
It builds a complete draft. And once that work in progress tree is finished, React enters a phase called reconciliation.
Okay, reconciliation. Walk us through that.
It walks down both trees simultaneously, compares the draft to the current tree, calculates the absolute minimal set of changes needed to update the screen, and then applies them all at once in a single batched commit to the browser's DOM.
You know, I love trying to visualize this process. It sounds a bit like a movie director shooting a complex scene.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah. So the current fiber tree is the film that is already in the can, right? It's shot, it's finalized. But then a script change comes in from the producers.
The state update.
Right. So the director doesn't just scrap the entire movie and reshoot it from page one. They create a work-in-progress storyboard. They sit down, compare the new storyboard to the existing film, and they only call the actors back to reshoot the exact frames that changed.
That analogy gets you like 90% of the way there.
Yeah.
But we do need to add a strict constraint to how your director makes decisions.
Okay, lay it on me.
React relies on three totally inflexible rules during this comparison phase. Rule number one dictates that if the element type changes at a specific location in the tree, say a div tag becomes a span tag, or component A becomes, component B React just assumes the entire structure below it is invalid.
Just gives up on it.
It completely destroys that entire subtree and rebuilds it from scratch. All internal state is permanently lost.
Okay, so in the movie analogy, if the script change swaps out the lead actor entirely, the director is forced to reshoot everything that new actor touches. You can't just digitally swap their face. You literally have to tear the whole set down.
Exactly. That is the heavy cost of rule one. This is why wrapping components in conditionals that switch between two completely different wrapper components is just wildly expensive.
Right, because it isn't a visual update. It's a full destruction and reconstruction of that section of the app.
Spot on.
Okay, so that is the destructive path. What are the other two rules?
So rule two is the fast path. If the element type is the exact same, React keeps the component instance alive and just updates the changed props.
Oh, so just changing a button from class name blue to class name red.
Yeah, that's just a single DOM attribute update. It's fast, it's cheap. Now, rule three applies specifically to lists of children. React uses keys to match elements between the old tree and the new tree.
Okay, and this is where it gets spicy. Because if React uses keys to track the identity of elements in a list, using the array index feels like a massive recipe for disaster when the order of that list changes.
It is a fatal flaw for dynamic lists. Let's walk through the exact failure state. Imagine you have a list of three items keyed 0, 1, and 2.
Okay, 0, 1, 2.
Now, you prepend a new item to the top of the list. The new item gets indexed 0, the old 0 becomes 1, and so on. But React doesn't conceptually understand that you shifted the list down. It strictly looks at the keys.
Oh, man. So it just sees that key 0 used to say apple, and now key 0 says orange.
Precisely. It thinks you just edited the data inside the existing component.
That's awful.
It is. So instead of cleanly inserting one new DOM node at the top, React surgically updates the contents of every single existing item in the list with a shifted data. It mutates the entire array.
Which is a massive performance hit.
Massive. And worse, if those list items had internal state, like, say, a checkbox that the user ticked, that state gets completely detached from the data it belongs to.
Right, the checkbox stays checked on the first item, even though the text changed from apple to orange.
Exactly. So keys are not just some unique identifier to silence your linter. They are the literal mechanism for component identity in the fiber tree.
Meaning if a key changes, React treats it as a brand new component, regardless of whether the element type is the same.
Yep. It unmounts the old one, resets all the state, runs all the cleanup functions, and mounts a fresh instance.
Which actually brings up a fascinating point from Luca Melle's writing, because he advocates for using this intentional destruction to your advantage.
The form reset trick.
Yes, the form reset trick. Explain that one.
Okay, consider a complex form used to edit user profiles in an administrative dashboard. When the administrator clicks a different user from a sidebar menu, you need that form to clear out the previous user's data and load the new user's information.
Right, obviously.
But the standard, messy way developers accomplish this is by writing a useEffect hook that watches the selected user ID. And when the ID changes, the effect fires and manually resets every single input state in the form.
Ugh, I have reviewed that code countless times. It is incredibly fragile.
So fragile.
Like someone adds a new field to the form 6 months later, they forget to add it to the manual reset effect, and suddenly you are saving the previous user's email address to the new user's profile.
Exactly. It creates super dangerous intermediate states. But the form reset trick eliminates that risk entirely. You simply pass keyUser.id onto the root component of the form itself.
Just one prop.
Just the key. When a different user is clicked, the key prop changes. React sees a new key, assumes it is a completely different component, destroys the old form, wipes the state completely clean, and builds a fresh form initialized with the new user's data.
And zero manual cleanup code is required.
None at all.
Okay, let me challenge that logic for a second based on what we just learned.
Go for it.
We literally just established in Rule 1 of Reconciliation that tearing down a component and rebuilding it from scratch is the most expensive operation React can perform. Why are we intentionally forcing that heavy operation just to clear out some text inputs?
It's a great question, and it comes down to a necessary architectural trade-off. You are absolutely correct that unmounting and remounting is heavier than a series of simple prop updates.
Right.
But we have to weigh the cost of performance against the cost of maintainability. Doing it intentionally via a key change guarantees a clean, predictable reset.
So you're choosing safety.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The alternative, that sprawling use effect chain manually syncing state, might theoretically save a few milliseconds of processing time, but it introduces massive fragility. In enterprise applications, taking a microsecond performance hit to guarantee data integrity and prevent corruption is the smarter architectural choice every single time.
Yeah, you're trading a microscopic optimization for complete stability. It's an interesting contrast because the instinct of most developers is to do the exact opposite.
Oh, for sure. We are terrified of rendering.
Right. We're so terrified of React doing any extra work that we try to hoard our components and variables using memoization. Let's dissect the memoization trap, specifically use memo and use callback.
The text really hammers this home. It highlights use memo as arguably the most overused hook in the entire React ecosystem.
It's everywhere.
Developers will wrap every single computed value, every filtered array, every basic math operation in it under the guise of performance.
But the article argues this actively backfires. How does trying to save performance actually hurt it?
Because use memo is not a free operation. It carries substantial overhead. When you invoke it, React actually has to allocate memory to store the previous result. It also has to allocate memory to store the dependency array.
Okay, so more memory overhead.
Yes. And then, on every single render cycle, it has to iterate through that dependency array and run a comparison algorithm to check if the new values match the old values.
Wow.
So if you were just doing some simple math or concatenating a first and last name into a string, the computational cost of iterating through those dependencies and comparing them is actually higher than just doing the string concatenation again.
I was trying to picture the absurdity of this. It feels like buying a $500 high-tech biometric safe to protect a $5 bill.
That is exactly what it is.
Like, yes, the $5 is theoretically secure from being lost, but you spent exponentially more resources on the security system than the asset is actually worth.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. You're adding complexity and computational overhead for a net negative return.
So when should we use it?
The guidelines specify that use memo should be reserved for genuinely expensive operations. We're talking about sorting massive arrays with thousands of objects or executing complex data parsing.
Okay, that makes sense.
The only other valid use case is for stabilizing memory references that are being passed down as props to child components.
Oh, let's explore that second use case, stabilizing references. This involves the relationship between use memo and react.memo, right?
Yes. If you use memo on an array prop purely to keep its memory address stable, but you pass it to a child component that does not have React.memo wrapping it.
Wait, let me guess. It does nothing.
It is doing absolutely nothing useful. The parent component will render, and because the child isn't memoized, the child will re-render anyway, completely bypassing your optimization attempt.
So they function as a pair.
Exactly. You need the stable reference from the parent and the memoized wrapper on the child to actually stop the render cascade.
Okay, wait. If useMemo has all this hidden overhead for variables, what about functions? I see code bases where every single function inside a component is wrapped in useCallback. Are we paying that same biometric safe tax just to define a simple click handler?
We absolutely are. UseCallback is literally just useMemo under the hood, tailored specifically for returning functions. It incurs the exact same memory allocation and comparison costs.
That's wild.
Luca Melle actually enforces a strict team rule at places like Migros and UBS regarding this. His engineers are not allowed to use callback unless they can explicitly point to the React.memo component or the use effect dependency array that actively benefits from that stable function reference.
So if you cannot name the downstream beneficiary, you are not allowed to use the hook. That is a fantastic mental filter. If you can't point to the safe, don't buy the lock.
Exactly.
So if we are tearing down use memo and use callback as these performance silver bullets,
we are left with a massive gap. If we cannot memoize heavy data parsing, how do we handle data efficiently without triggering unnecessary work?
Well, the answer lies in features of use state and use ref that most developers completely ignore.
Oh, let's start with use state and lazy initialization.
Yeah, usually when we use use state, we just pass the default value right into the parentheses. But the hook can accept a raw value or it can accept a function. And this distinction is highly critical for performance.
How so?
Let's imagine your initial state needs to read from local storage and parse a massive JSON object. If you write use state and then immediately put JSON.parse inside it.
Wait, the JavaScript engine evaluates that parsing operation before React even sees it, doesn't it?
Correct. Because of how JavaScript argument evaluation works, that heavy parsing code is executed on every single render cycle.
Even though React doesn't need it?
Right. React only actually uses the result of that parse on the very first mount to set the initial state. On every subsequent render, the JavaScript engine does all the heavy lifting to parse the JSON, hands it to React, and React immediately throws it in the garbage because the state is already initialized.
It's just burning CPU cycles for absolutely no reason. So how do we bypass the JavaScript evaluation?
With a one-character addition, you just wrap the heavy operation in an arrow function. You write useState, parenthesis, arrow function, JSON.parse. By passing a function, you are utilizing lazy initialization.
So React takes control.
Exactly. It will invoke that function solely on the initial mount and completely skip the execution on every subsequent rerender.
It's amazing how much computational waste is saved by adding a single arrow function.
It really is.
Now, if we need to track data that changes over time, we have to talk about useRef. I feel like useRef is kind of the misunderstood middle child of React.
It really is.
Like most bootcamps teach you to use it when you need to focus an HTML input element and they just leave it at that.
Grabbing DOM elements is the most visible use case, but it completely misses the architectural superpower of the hook. useRef is essentially a mutable container.
Okay, a container.
Right. Under the hood, React gives you a plain JavaScript object with a current property. The magic is that React stores this object completely outside the component's render cycle.
Outside the cycle?
Yes. You can mutate the current property all day long, and because it sits outside the render cycle, updating it will never, ever trigger a reconciliation or a re-render.
Okay, so if I have a piece of data that is constantly updating, how do I know if it belongs in use state, which triggers the render engine, or use ref, which silently bypasses it?
It comes down to a really simple visual heuristic. You just ask yourself, does the user screen need to change when this specific piece of data changes?
Well,
if the answer is yes, like if a counter needs to visually increment from 1 to 2 on the screen, it must go in use state. Mm. But if the data is just doing background math or tracking a timer interval or holding on to a previous value for a logical comparison, put it in use ref.
Right, because if you put a background timer in use state, updating that invisible tick every millisecond is going to force the entire component tree to reconcile continuously.
Precisely. You are forcing the engine to do work the user will literally never see. The text also highlights using useRef to solve the dreaded stale closure problem.
Oh, the stale closure. That's when an asynchronous function, like a useEffect or a timeout, gets trapped, looking at an old snapshot of your state variables from the time the effect was created rather than the current values.
Yes, it's so frustrating to debug. But by storing your latest callbacks or state values inside a ref, your effects can always access the freshest data via that current property without you needing to constantly tear down and rebuild your effects every time a variable changes.
That's incredibly elegant. We have spent all this time inside the engine room looking at memory allocation, linked lists, and render cycles. I want to step back and look at the vehicle as a whole, you know?
Okay, let's zoom out.
How do all these micro-level React rules fit into the broader philosophy of a master architect?
Well, when you synthesize Luca's architectural manifesto and his years of leading massive front-end teams, a very clear golden rule emerges. Render less. Don't memoize more.
Let me repeat that. Render less, don't memoize more.
Exactly. The instinct to fix a sluggish application is usually to plaster use memo everywhere. But the architectural solution is actually to fix the component structure, move state down the tree to where it is actually consumed.
Give me an example of that.
So if a user types into a search input in your site's header, that keystroke state should not live at the root of the application, forcing the entire page layout to reconcile on every single key press.
Oh, right. You isolate the state.
Isolate it. Put it in the header component, or better yet, just the search component.
This philosophy pairs directly with his rule of least power, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. The rule of least power dictates that engineers should always use the least powerful language or tool necessary to achieve a result. If you can solve a UI problem with pure HTML, you must use HTML.
No React allowed for that.
Nope. If HTML isn't enough, use CSS. Only if those two fail do you reach for JavaScript. And only if raw JavaScript is somehow insufficient do you reach for the complexity of React. He specifically notes in his best practices that simply wanting to write pure HTML is very rarely a valid reason to extract something into a React component.
This brings us to a principle that, frankly, goes against almost everything taught in modern software education. In his guidelines, he actively advocates for Yeganai over DRI.
Yeah, that one usually raises some eyebrows.
I mean, Yeganai being the acronym for you aren't going to need it, and DRY being don't repeat yourself. DRI is practically a religion for developers, right? We are taught to abstract any repeated code immediately. But Luca is telling enterprise teams to tolerate duplicate code.
He is. And it's because developers chronically misunderstand what DRI actually means. DRI means do not repeat business logic. It does not mean do not repeat code.
Wait, clarify that distinction.
If two pieces of code look identical right now, but they serve entirely different business domains or user flows, they should remain duplicated.
Because if you abstract them into a shared component, you are permanently tying their fates together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Premature abstraction is the ultimate villain of scalable architecture. The manifesto gives a really great example regarding a standard button component. Imagine you have a standard submit button and a file download button.
Okay, two buttons.
Right. In the initial design phase, they look exactly the same. Same padding, same blue background. A junior developer will look at that, apply the DRY principle, and say, let's make one shared component and add a conditional prop. So they write button download true and button download false.
Which feels like beautifully clean code on day one.
On day one, sure. But look at the life cycle of that component over 6 months. The business decides the download button needs a cloud icon, a specific loading spinner, and maybe an analytics tracking pixel. The regular submit button needs none of those.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Because they are tied together, the developer is forced to hack messy Boolean conditionals into the shared component. You end up drilling 10 different props into a component just to manage the divergent logic. You've created a testing nightmare simply because two buttons shared a few lines of CSS 6 months ago.
So how does the architect solve the button problem instead?
Through composition. You keep the base button pure and strictly focused on styles. Then you create a separate button download component that renders the standard button inside of it, but handles its own download logic independently.
Oh, so if the code diverges, they are safely separated.
Yes. You aren't forcing two unrelated business features into a single point of failure.
When we pull all of these threads together, it becomes incredibly clear that building truly great React applications isn't about memorizing the newest experimental hooks. And it certainly isn't about blindly applying bootcamp dogmas like DRY to everything you see.
Not at all. It is about respecting the engine. It requires understanding that the fiber tree dictates performance and that utilizing keys properly manages component identity. It means avoiding the trap of premature memorization, leveraging refs for invisible data, and trusting simpler native tools whenever possible.
The core of this deep dive really rests on that rule of least power HTML before CSS, CSS before JavaScript, JavaScript before React. So as you step away from this discussion and look at your own code base, take a hard look at the complex React state, the massive use effect chains, and the convoluted memorization you are wrestling with today. How much of that complexity could actually be completely deleted and replaced by a simple native HTML attribute or a basic CSS rule? Are you trying to outsmart an engine when you could just be using the code?
That is a phenomenal question to ask yourself before submitting your next pull request.
Until next time, keep diving deep.